Now, second reading, and the focus of our reflection this morning from the prophet Jeremiah, chapter 2, and you can find this text printed inside your bulletin. Jeremiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 13. And let me just say that what I'm going to be doing this morning is an introduction to our Lenten sermon series, Pilgrim's Progress, looking at the seven deadly sins. This morning, if you will, getting an orientation to the problem we have of sin. Jeremiah writes and says, "The word of the Lord came to me, 'Go and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem, I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me, followed me through the desert, through a land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. All who devoured her were held guilty, and disaster overtook them,' said the Lord, declares the Lord. 'Hear the word of the Lord, O house of Jacob, all you clans of the house of Israel. This is what the Lord says. What fault did your fathers find in me that they strayed so far from me? They followed worthless idols and became worthless themselves. They did not ask, where is the Lord who brought us up out of Egypt and led us through the barren wilderness, through a land of deserts and rifts, a land of drought and darkness, a land where no one travels and no one lives? I brought you into a fertile land to eat its fruit and rich produce, but you came and defiled my land and made my inheritance detestable. The priests did not ask, where is the Lord? Those who deal with the law did not know me. The leaders rebelled against me. The prophets prophesied by Baal, following worthless idols. Therefore I bring charges against you, declares the Lord, and I will bring charges against your children's children. Cross over to the coasts of Kittim and look, send to Kedar and observe closely. See if there has ever been anything like this. Has a nation ever changed its gods? Yet they're not gods at all. But my people have exchanged their glory for worthless idols. Be appalled at this, O heavens. Shudder with great horror, declares the Lord. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water. And they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water." This is the word of the Lord. About 325 years or so ago, there lived a man named John Bunyan. Some of you maybe have heard of him, a celebrated writer of a book called The Pilgrim's Progress, what many people consider to be sort of the first or the most inspiring beginning for what the form that would become the English novel, though he never himself considered it a novel. Bunyan was a man who had lived a very hard life. He was poor. He was recruited into the parliamentary army at the time of the English Revolution and saw service under Oliver Cromwell. Later, he was converted and discerned a call into the Christian ministry. He was a Baptist, and in those days, it was illegal to be a Baptist preacher in England because of the establishment. And so, because of his preaching, Bunyan spent nearly 12 years in jail. Now, while he was in jail because of this, before he was released, he conceived an idea, no doubt from his own life, an idea that being a Christian, being a follower of Christ, is a pilgrimage. It has a beginning in faith. But it also is a story that there's a story that goes from conversion until the time we see Christ. And if you ever read this or read it with your children, you know, there are just unforgettable scenes in this book, Pilgrim's Progress. This man who begins with a great burden of guilt on his back, and his guilt is taken away with the good news of the gospel that an evangelist brings him. And yet, the journey's not over as soon as he hears the good news of the gospel. That's sort of, you know, that's page 3, I think, actually, of a 300-page book. There's still a pilgrimage in front of him. And so he winds up going to places like doubting castle, having to deal with his own questions and his own doubts. He despairs and he finds himself, and I love this name, in the Slough of Despond. He goes to Doubting Castle. He goes to the Slough of Despond. He has to deal with his own sins and temptations in the world as he passes through the great city known as Vanity Fair. I've always thought it was interesting that people felt comfortable enough to celebrate a magazine and call it Vanity Fair, which comes from Bunyan's idea of an utterly degenerate city that will destroy you. Vanity Fair. And finally, he crosses the river of death into the celestial city. Now, I talk about this theme, and I would encourage you, this is a great Lenten project, read The Pilgrim's Progress. It is one of the most wonderful, encouraging things you'll ever work through in terms of understanding what the nature of the Christian life is all about. It's a real classic. But my question is this: are you a person who thinks of your life as a pilgrimage? Now, see, here's the problem. I think there are tend to be sort of two extremes when you ask the pilgrimage question. Are you going somewhere? You know, the Apostle Paul put it very passionately. He didn't even think of himself walking on a pilgrimage. He thought of himself running a race. I'm running a race, and I'm headed somewhere, and I don't want to be disqualified. I want to run passionately and clearly. I don't want to be unencumbered. Are you a person who thinks of yourself as being on a pilgrimage? Now, I think there's sort of two pitfalls with the pilgrimage idea. One is you get so focused on your own pilgrimage. You become so focused on what's going on in your life, so focused on your issues, that you become a very self-absorbed and, in a certain sense, loveless person. You just think the pilgrimage is all about you rather than the world God wants to bring His grace into and to the lives of other people He wants to use you in. And so you either become, and I don't think one is worse than the other, you either become a person who's horribly driven because you're so focused on your own performance and your own righteousness, or you become a person who tends to fall into despair because you focus and you try and you work and you fail, and it just pushes you further and further down into despair. So there's sort of the one extreme of the person who just is totally self-absorbed and it has all sorts of bad results. Though I think what is more common is the person who may be able to give some lip service, some perfunctory language about, oh yes, I'm on a spiritual pilgrimage. But the fact is, when it comes to the workaday life, when it comes to day in and day out, you're basically in denial when it comes to the issue of pilgrimage. You're really not thinking about whether or not you're really a person who's growing in freedom from your sin, growing in holiness, and growing more and more like Christ's likeness. You've sort of hit a nice acceptable medium. You know, maybe you're middle class, you're respectable, your language is, you know, more or less clean, you're nice, people like your cookies, they ask you for your recipes, you got all these things down, and at this point, in a certain sense, you're thinking, you know, I'm holding pretty steady here. Yep. I'm on a steady pilgrimage. And so there's no sense in which you ever are really looking hard at your own life and saying, am I growing? Am I really serious? Is this idea of pilgrimage one of the defining characteristics of my life? Now, Lent, this idea I was talking about earlier, it's an old English word that means spring. I like to think of it as an ancient, great idea. And I say this because the idea is this. Rather than simply saying to individuals, you know, you ought to examine your lives, it's actually a communal event where, as a church, we encourage one another in a communal way and say, you know what, we ought to examine our lives. Now, of course, this is something we always do, but in a unique sense, let's stop. And every year, before we go into Easter, let's examine our hearts, let's examine our lives, and see what's going on. The original motivation was the way the early church looked at the 40 days that men like Moses and Elijah took to fast. That is, to set aside ordinary routines of food and other good things in order to create room to look at your life, to listen to your life, to look at what's going on. And it became such a good idea that when people would prepare for baptism, what was known as the catechumenate, those who were coming into the church being baptized at Easter, the whole church would actually go into a season with them of self-examination as a way of saying, where are we headed really? What's going on in our life? And as soon as I began to study this, I realized I think this is a great tradition that has a lot to give to us. Now, let me also talk about this component of our reflection on the seven deadly sins. The seven deadly sins are really almost as old as Christianity itself. From very early on, people who took the spiritual life seriously began to reflect on the scriptures and said, you know, there are certain things that just sort of arise as very central patterns to be concerned about. Very central things that what they call deadly meant they literally can destroy you and they can destroy the spiritual life. They come into their most codified and clear form in the 4th century under two monastic leaders in Egypt, one named John Cassian and the other Evagrius of Pontus. And a few centuries later, the Pope, Gregory the Great, looked at their thoughts, and they had actually come up with 8 deadly sins. And he thought, you know, maybe they were fudging. They had vainglory and pride, and Gregory thought, you know, I struggle with both of those, and I think they're the same sin. So the 8 deadly thoughts became the 7 deadly sins. It wasn't like they decided to edit them because there was one they didn't think was a sin. It's just they thought 2 of the sins kind of looked like the same sin. So they came up with a list of 7. But it's really been around for a long time. And the list we're going to look at is this: pride, avarice or greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. Now this morning, briefly, I want to look at Jeremiah, if you will, the way he sets us up for what is behind those sins, and really all sins. What is our problem in the pilgrimage? Well, Jeremiah goes to people who consider themselves the people of God. He's one of the last prophets sent to Judah before their culture and their nation literally collapses, before they're invaded and carried away. And when he goes there, what you have recorded in this book most likely are sermons that he would have preached day in and day out, now collected in a written form. Sermons that are God's word, sermons that are God's way of, if you will, intervening in this frozen spirituality that people have, this contentedness they have with all the sin that is reeking through their life. They've become content to say, yes, we're Israel, we're the people of God, and, you know, everybody does it. And yet, at the same time, they see their culture crumbling. They see their world falling apart. They see the threat coming upon them. And so they're very passionately beginning to ask questions like, why is this happening? Why is this happening to us? Why are we suffering? What's going on? And what we read here in chapter 2 is this. When they ask questions like, why are we suffering? What's going wrong? Jeremiah unloads on them, basically to say, has it not yet occurred to you that you're not really an innocent victim? And I know there's some of you like this. Maybe what brings you to a church is you're at the end of your tether, you're at the end of your rope, and you're angry, and you say, what's wrong? What am I doing wrong? And what Jeremiah says to these people is, did it never occur to you that what's wrong is that you're not right with God? Did it ever occur to you that what's wrong is that you're not right? You don't have a right relationship with God. These are people who are, I've been using the psychological language. They're people who are in denial about their true condition. Notice what he says as we read through the text. He asks these questions and he says, they never even ask, where is the Lord? The priests don't even ask, where is the Lord? The people aren't even saying, maybe things aren't right with the Lord because of things that are in my life that I prefer to the Lord. Of course, Jeremiah's harangue here, the word has been coined because he does this so often, his Jeremiad, his sermon that he's launching against this behavior, is that you're not even asking. So you could say that what you have in this prophecy is an intervention with people who are in deep denial about what's going on in their life. You know, when I first moved to New York City, I rented an apartment from someone who lived in the complex. It was an older woman. And she seemed like the nicest person you'd ever meet. And what I didn't know until I got there was that she was an alcoholic. And that her alcoholism had destroyed her relationships with her family. It had cost her her job. And it was causing great problems in the church she was part of. And so after I'd been there about a month, and very strange things started happening in this place where we were living, I knew that this was a person with a real problem. So the minister from this church called me and said, "We want you to get involved in an intervention." I don't know, you may have seen these on television. You may have been part of one. Somebody may have done one to you. But it was one of the most sad things I'd ever seen, because we called her to come to something, and here I was, the guy who had only been there about 6 months, and her daughter, and her ex-husband, and her employer, and her minister, and the people who used to be her best friends. And we sat around the room, and basically each one gently and lovingly told her how painful it was to watch her destroy herself in front of our eyes. The saddest thing about the intervention was she didn't hear us and basically was convinced that we had the problem. And tragically, that's what it basically happens in Israel under the ministry of Jeremiah. And frankly, it's commonly what happens in the human condition. God has an intervention in His Word that comes in and says, there is a desperate and deadly illness within you that must be dealt with. And we find ways to rationalize the seriousness of what's going on. Now, I want us to focus on the 13th verse here to focus our thoughts. And this is what God says to the prophet Jeremiah the problem basically is. Here's the intervention language. Here's the clear assessment of what's going on. My people have committed two sins. In other words, he's boiling it down, if you will. This is deadly sin language. They've actually done lots and lots of things. If you read the book of Jeremiah, there's just tons of stuff they do. But God himself boils it down and says, look, there's basically two things going on here. And it's this. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water. And they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns, that cannot hold water. The first thing we see here is that sin is, in our hearts, a forsaking of God, the spring of living water. You know, one of the most well-known texts about sin is Psalm 51, where David repents of his sin of adultery with Bathsheba. And one of the things he says in that is, it's very interesting, he says, against you and you only have I sinned. That is, at its core, sin is primarily and ultimately against God. And it is something that God takes deeply, deeply and personally. In fact, the word in Psalm 51 literally is rebelled. Against you have I rebelled. The emphasis being here this. Sin isn't just breaking the rules. Sin isn't just turning into a criminal by breaking the commandments. Sin is literally treason. Sin is the act of a traitor. It's taking what your identity is to be, namely what we were all created to be, the image of God, those who love God with our whole hearts, who love our neighbors as ourselves. That's what we were built to be. It's taking your very... What does a traitor do? You take your very country, your very identity, and you throw it away for something else. That's what sin is. Notice how, as when we began, the language God used to describe the sin of His people. I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert. What is he saying? And then he goes on to say how you ran off and you left me for other gods. This is the language of a wounded lover. In fact, the lover image is one of the most significant and common images used in the scriptures to describe God's love for us and what he desires. He created us to love him. Now, I know there are people here who say, now, wait a minute. This is written to Israel, to Jacob, all these people. I'm not even Jewish. What does this have to do with me? No. If you're here and you're a Christian, if you are here and you're not a Christian, there's still a deep application to this because you were created. Your design as a human being is in the image of God. In the same way that the moon shows its fullest glory when it reflects the fullness of the sun, so to be a human being, you will never tap into who you really are, into the fullness of your potential, until you know what it is to be in relationship with God, to know His love, and to show His love. And yet, we're traitors, and God's language to that treason is very much that of a jilted lover. I know there are people here who've gone through the pain of divorce. You hopefully have gotten some encouragement and counseling, but you know, I don't think there's anything. I can't even imagine it. I don't think there's anything in this world that could be more painful than to have someone commit to be yours, to commit to be your love, to commit to be faithful to you, and then to abandon those promises, perhaps even most painfully, for the arms of another person. And that is exactly the insight Jeremiah gives us into the heart of our God. That is exactly how God sees the sins that we become so comfortable with. They're nothing short of abject betrayal. We're created to love God. Now, you see, there's a side effect that comes here. If we're created to be the lovers of God, to know deep, joyous fellowship with Him, there's a terrible side effect that comes if we don't enjoy that with Him. You know, have you noticed these new commercials for drugs? I hope you're not in that industry because I just hate them. You know, where they have like these smiling people running around because they're taking this new drug, and they're running around, you know, going, oh, we're so happy because we're taking zincafan, metal fluoral, lethylene or whatever. And they're dancing and they're singing and there's music, and then there's somebody's voice going, sometimes this will cause your bowels to explode and your mucus will catch on fire, and, you know, all these things. Sort of, if you've seen these kind of commercials, you know. Now, here's the thing. You know, there's a terrible side effect that comes from being someone created for glory. If you're created for glory, created for God, with that capacity for love, you see, if you turn away from Him, then you're going to turn to something else with a vengeance. You see, you don't have the capacity to run away. You know, which would you rather encounter, a rabid lion or a rabid mouse? See, a human being with a broken relationship with God is a rabid lion. You see, you're created for love and relationship with God. And so when you turn away from that, you must fill that glory somewhere else. And that's what the Bible calls idolatry. It's anything and everything other than God you turn to fill the hunger and thirst in your heart. And you know, I'm gonna read you something pretty graphic. This comes later on in this chapter. Let me read you verses 23 and 24. This is what God said, verse 24. This is how He describes them. When they turned away from Him to anything else, He says, you're a swift she-camel running here and there, a wild donkey accustomed to the desert, sniffing the wind in her craving, in her heat. Who can restrain her? His picture of the human heart is of an animal in heat. An animal in heat, so passionate that it overrides conscience, it overrides sensibility, it overrides anything you think through, because the glory must be found. The glory must be tasted. It must be had. You know, why do we have to reproduce? Why do we have to deal with those overwhelming, compelling issues? You know, there is a biochemical issue that, frankly, you know, we're going to die unless we perpetuate, unless we create. There's a sense in which we're incomplete as a people or as a species of animals, unless there's mating that happens and there's completion that finds there. Well, in the same way, you're not complete. You simply cannot stand on your own. You're going to find completion somewhere. You're going to seek it out somewhere. You're either going to find it with your God, or in the heat, in the passionate desire to be completed, the thing that overrides, the thing you can't control, you're going to seek to find it somewhere else other than God. So God says, you forsake me, the source of living water. And secondly, you dig your own cisterns that cannot hold water. That is, you look somewhere else to get your water, to quench your thirst. Now, by the way, this is a message not just for somebody here who's not a Christian, But for you, if you are a Christian, this is written to people who believe. This is people who've been on a pilgrimage for a long time. And the word is, you have idols too. You have idols. Now, those idols can look, you know, I mean, you may be here, and I mean, you may have idols of wood and stone. I don't know. It's the 2000s. Who knows what's going on? But the fact is, it can be anything. It can be a relationship that you want so badly, it colors everything in your life because you're just convinced you're not going to be completed unless you're married or unless you're divorced. It can go the other way. This is so bad unless I get out of this, I'll never be completed. It may be being the parent everyone admires, being the one who's got the perfect kids, that is such a compulsion for you. It is absolutely your idol. And everything, you see, your heat is that you must have that. There's some of you, it's your work. It's getting your security, getting your sense of acceptance, your sense of worth out of being a person who has a certain amount of money, who has a certain amount of success. Here's the problem. Your sense of self, your very self, is as fragile as the idol you build your life on. And every one of those idols will implode. You know, if you make your idol a human relationship, don't you see what's going to happen? You're going to look to this person. You know, you're going to go to this person, Jeremiah would say, in heat, wanting to find all your glory, all your sense of love, everything you need from this person. And what happens? You absolutely suck the life out of them. And then the relationship's destroyed. And you say to God, how could you let this happen? Well, you made it happen because you made this thing your idol. And it, see, you're, again, the rabid lion. Your need for glory is so great. No idol can bear its weight. So he says, you dig cisterns, and none of those cisterns, do you understand the image here? None of those cisterns will hold water. They're going to crack. There's nothing that can supplant the place of God in the human heart, ever. It will crack. It will give way. Now, right now, you might be under the delusion. You know, you can, if you're a drug addict and you're high, there's a sense in which you go, cistern's got some pretty good water right now. Wait, the idol will implode. It will destroy you. It will not fill you, and it will not give you glory. You know, in the ancient world, let me tell you what a cistern was. You live out in a desert climate. What you do with the little water you have is you dig a hole, you put some plaster in there, you know, you form a pot, and you keep your water there in the ground. It stays cool, and it keeps you alive. Now, sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? Notice how God describes himself as living, flowing water. Cisterns really have two problems. The one problem is the cistern cracks and you come in and you're parched and you're within an ounce of your life and you go to throw your head in the cistern and you just hit your head on the cracked pot because there's nothing there. In other words, you think there's water there, you go and there's nothing there. The other thing that happens that's just as bad is, you know, in the ancient world they didn't really understand things like parasites and bacteria. So you go to the cistern, you plunge your head in, you begin to drink, and you think you're getting something that's going to give you life. And frankly, it's going to give you something else. Give it about 6 hours. And you're going to get something in there that's very bad for you. Frankly, maybe even deadly. The point God is making through the prophet Jeremiah is this. If you drink anything to fill your heart, to fill it at its deepest need other than me, you're going to die of thirst. And that's the last thing I want to say this morning, which is that the heart, the message, the encouraging word behind this prophecy is that God, even though he speaks these hard words to them, hard words of judgment, still says, I am a God of mercy and I'm a God of living water. And if you read through this prophecy, every other chapter, he keeps saying, return to me and I will give you living water. Don't drink. Don't drink at the other fountains. They're going to kill you. They're going to destroy you. Come to me, and I will give you living water. You know, there was a Jewish festival that was called the Feast of Tabernacles. And in that festival, the Jewish people would remember the ways God had given them fresh water in the desert. And the highlight of the ceremony was when the high priest would take a flagon of water and he would pour it out onto the arid ground as a remembrance that God would always give them water. We're told in the Gospel of John, chapter 7, that Jesus went to that feast And on the last day of the feast, presumably when the flagon was being poured out and the water was being poured out, Jesus drew attention to himself and he shouted with a loud voice, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scriptures have said and prophesied, out of your heart will overflow rivers of living water." Do you hear that promise that Jesus Christ gives us? That if we come to him, he will give you sweet water that will fill your heart. And what does it mean to drink? It means to believe. It just means to believe the gospel of what's been offered to you in Christ. It means he will give you a drink that will give you freedom and life, living water. How does that work? Very simply. Look at your guilt. When you look at the cross, not only when you become a Christian, but for the whole of your life, whenever you have real guilt or even false guilt, to drink is to believe, to look at the cross, and to be able to preach the gospel to yourself, to pray and say, "I believe, I drink, and I believe that Jesus Christ died for my sin, whatever it is, and I am forgiven." Can you drink in the midst of your guilt? Believe and know that he died for you? But it's not just the guilt of sin. It's also the power of sin. The sin that you know, the one that haunts you. The one you don't want to, you know, the one you don't want to talk about in front of your community group or your small group of any sort. The one you never mention to your spouse, though they probably see it all the time and it drives them crazy. The besetting sin, the one that's there that says, listen, to drink is to know that you can be free from the power of sin. Not just the guilt, but the power. Don't you know what the big lie is? The big lie, it's, you know, the beautiful thing about drinking, it's such a powerful analogy. The big lie is when we look at the gospel, we look at Jesus saying, "I'll give you living water. I will give you my spirit, my presence, a new heart." It's a clear, solid promise. You hear that, and the fact is, you don't believe it. And what you believe is, where I'm really going to get water, where I'm really going to get what I need, where I'm really going to get what's going to give me deep heart, soul satisfaction and joy, is this other cistern, because you know what? I go there all the time. It's where I get my water. And even though you know it's giving you parasites, even though it's not filling your thirst, you just default and you go there. You know, the great thing about drinking, it's a singular action. When you're, you know, I don't care what the ventriloquists say, you know, I think when you're drinking, it's all you can do, and you can only drink one thing at a time. When you sin, when you give in, don't you see what you're doing? You're stopping drinking the gospel. You have to stop drinking it so that you can go drink something else. In John 7, when Jesus says, "Let him come to me and drink," he uses a Greek verb that has a continuous sense that means, let him keep on drinking. The whole of your life is nothing but drinking this living water. My friends, whether you're not a Christian and you're looking to Christ for the first time, or you've been a Christian all your life, I ask you, do you and are you, do you know what it is to believe in Jesus in such a way that it's the deepest sustenance of your soul? Jesus appeared on a mountain. He showed his glories to his disciples. And my friends, he wasn't just saying, "This is who I am." What he was saying is, "This is what I'm committed to make you. This is the glory I'm committed to your sharing. Come to me and drink." Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you that rather than giving us a complex scheme, you give us a very simple offer, a very simple offer that says, come and drink and you will give. Give us the wisdom to see the broken cisterns that we're running through.